So I shared at the first service that I played oboe for 12 years. I know, Cheryl, you played oboe. Yeah. Any other oboists out there? It's not? Well, yes. And what a gift. What a gift. It's not an instrument that I've heard much at the fellowship, so thank you so much. It was really beautiful. Thank you both. And I always love Eric's playing, and Anna, too. All right, so we have a bunch of questions. Work. It's good. Thank you. I'm going to start, though, by talking about my sabbatical, and this may actually answer a few of the questions. There's five things I want to tell you about the sabbatical. So this will come up for me. It starts early August, goes through early December. And the first thing I want to say is that I'm really grateful to be able to have a sabbatical. I'm very, keenly aware that most people in the United States do not get sabbaticals in their line of work. And so I do not take it for granted. It is a huge gift. And I also appreciate that I haven't had anyone tell me, "You jerk, you got a sabbatical, I don't." So I appreciate that too. I'm really grateful. And I wish anyone who did any job which has any element of creativity, which is really most jobs, I wish everybody could have one, because I think it would help everybody reimagine things and come back fresh and new ideas. And so I think it's great. There is a sabbatical brochure, second thing. It's out in the lobby on the welcome table. If you haven't picked up a copy, I hope you do. It's got elaboration on how things will work here, what I'm going to do with the time, things like that. And third thing, just briefly, is I'm going to be in London. I'm going to work a little bit for a church there, preach a couple times a month. It's got, they have 25 people at a service. I'm not going to do much else there, and that's good, because I don't want to do what I do here or there. That would kind of defeat the purpose. So I'll have lots of time, which is great. One of the things I want to look at while I'm there is why one or two UU congregations, Unitarian there in London, are doing well, while most of them are not doing well at all. Like most British churches, they're kind of going down. It's a very secularized culture. And so what is it about these one or two that's working? We know in the United States that we're on a trend of increasing secularism. I heard lately in Portland, Oregon, that about somewhere between 4% and 8% of people go regularly to church. And so I think this issue is going to come this way, to the United States and eventually even to the Fox cities. What is it that we could do to position ourselves to continue to grow and thrive? If we get lumped with every other church, let's say Alliance and the Catholic Church, we're all the same, we're not going to do very well. And I think a lot of people, because religion is such a bad brand in the United States today, are increasingly doing that. So what can we do to appeal to people who have really given up on religion? I think we have a great opportunity there, but I don't think it's a slam dunk. Fourth thing is that a lot of people ask, is my wife Amy going to go? And she's going to go for a portion of it, 5-6 weeks, which is what she can get with vacation and a little bit of unpaid time. So I'm really glad we'll have some time together. There's just no way to make it the whole thing. And finally, my hopes for the fellowship and for me, I guess I shared a little bit about me. I hope to come back really rejuvenated. There's an element of ministry that's a burden, honestly. It's a burden I generally love, but I'll like a break from it. I'm especially going to like not having a lot of night meetings, any. I'm gonna like not answering email. And no, you can't email me there. And I'm going to like not feeling that sort of day-to-day burden of keeping things running. So that's what I'm looking forward to. I think for the fellowship, it's going to be helpful to know that things are going to be fine without me here. I've been here a long time, but I'm not indispensable. Nobody is. If I am indispensable, then the fellowship has trouble, because at some point I won't be here. So my hope is that I'll get back and you will all say, "Yeah, we're glad to have you back, but really things went pretty well." That would be great. I'd love that. So that's about the sabbatical. I'm going to launch into the questions. What I'm going to do is go through them And, you know, this is going to be superficial. I don't have time to do a sermon on each one, thankfully. But if we have time at the end, then we'll come back and I'll walk this mic around and see if you have anything you want to follow up on. So, and these are, I'm going to actually mix them up. I haven't looked at them. Usually I look at them, but I wanted to hear the oboe, so I didn't. Unseen. Unseen by my human eyes. Okay. This looks like a two-parter. One, I know we have groups that reach out to underprivileged groups in the community, but what are we doing to invite them here? And second, do you think our fellowship creates an unwelcoming place through privilege, class, ethnic majority? Really great questions. My hope is that, and I think more than we may realize, we have economic diversity in the congregation. We have all income levels from low to high. And I wish we were even more diverse than that, but I think we may have more diversity than we think we have. Clearly, I think in terms of ethnicity and race, we have much less diversity, and we don't reflect this area, which is increasingly diverse with, I don't know, is it 15 to 20%, non-Caucasian. So we have a ways to go, and I think what we can do, first of all, is try to get clarity ourselves on who we are and what privileges accompany who we are. Until we're clear on that, I don't think we'll ever be welcoming to other people. So that's step one. And step two, I think, is finding ourselves, I hope, in different circles, at work, with friends, in neighborhoods, and actually inviting people to come here. We have a hard time doing that as Unitarian Universalists because we don't want to proselytize. What I hope is that we can invite people to come here. Not say, and you're going to go to hell if you don't. But say, hey, this is something that's valuable to me. You might like it. I'd love to. You could come if you want to. You know, just something like that. And if we can make progress individually on widening our circle, and we do that, we'll be able to widen the circle of the fellowship. So I think that's part of what we can do. But again, step one is an understanding of privilege and class. As one transitions into developing healthier relationships and leaving the old behind and embracing who one truly is, what are some things to do to help embrace change? Embracing change, I think, is one of the principal spiritual challenges for anybody, because we know in the life course things change. As we age, things change. As we have children, things change. As relationships perhaps end, things change. So I think any spirituality has to take account of this and has to give us some sort of grounding that helps us remember who we are through all these changes. Maybe that's the nutshell of what the spiritual practice, what a spiritual practice should do. Help us remember who we are as all these circumstances change, and then try to be who we are, even as things change. And we also know who we are changes too. So a spiritual practice needs to take that into account. I think a spiritual practice should help us check in with, you know, what's going on inside, who we are, and that'll help us then deal with the change going on around us. I hope the fellowship does that, but I think there's a real individual piece there too. And so I would encourage you, if you don't have some sort of spiritual practice, to think about getting one. Unless you're pretty sure that you'll never have a challenge in life and things are going to stay exactly the way they are today. And good luck with that. How can Unitarian Universalists, with our fundamental belief in the need to make our world better, cope with belief systems in which the world doesn't matter at all? How do we counter apathy about climate change, for instance, that's fueled by a desire to leave this planet behind? There's sort of two elements there. One is, I think, whenever we hold a position strongly, we need to try not to demonize those who disagree. And that's really hard. I get that. It's hard for me. But I think that's what we have to do. Because we may be wrong. We may have an incomplete view. I don't know about you, but I've had ideas I felt really strongly about that I realized later were either incomplete or wrong. So I don't need to demonize people who disagree. As far as valuing the planet, I think we just have to keep witnessing that we do value the planet. We do value it. We think it's important. We think this is our lifeblood. We think we owe it to the next generations. We need to do that. Climate change is hard because I know I have a carbon footprint that's bigger than it should be. I bet a lot of us do. And so it's easy to talk about other people and these people that, you know, want to junk the planet because they think they're going to heaven anyway. Okay, but probably I'm going to be better off looking at what I'm doing, you know, and taking a hard look and trying to be better. Yeah, I think that's where it starts. My connection to people's grief and loss is often intense and empathic. Sometimes I feel like I'm a walking grief bomb. Well, that's good. I do too. How might I lighten and bring light to this heaviness to my and their spirits? You know, I try to really learn from people who are dealing with grief, either grief about their own upcoming death or other people's. And what I've observed is that some people are just amazingly adept at handling it, really. You know, so they deal with the real stuff of it, but they also seem to maintain a perspective. So I try to learn from people. My favorite book on grief is by Stephanie Erickson, and it's called A Companion Through Grief, something like that. And she lost her husband when she was like 35, little kid. He suddenly dropped of a heart attack. And it about killed her, and she writes about that, but she also writes about how she got through it. Different person, changed person, but what she came away with was a real cherishing of life and of relationships. And so it wasn't ultimately destructive for her. I learned from that. Learn from others, that's what I'd say. That's one reason we're in community. I can tell you people here who have wisdom to share about grief. What are you looking forward to most this fall? No email, no night meetings. And I actually I really like the London style of ale, so I'm looking forward to that too. How successful do you think the fellowship is leading in social justice? I think we both do better than we sometimes think we do, and we have a long ways to go. A mission statement should not be about who we are today, but who we aspire to be. And so when we decided part of our mission is leading in social justice, that was an aspiration, not necessarily a fact. So I appreciate that, and I think it's a slow road, and we're getting there. I have an idea of how we could get there quicker, and I'll share that in a minute. But to me, I do want to lift up the activities we're doing here at the Fellowship that change lives, with our Hunger and Homelessness Task Force, for example, with our international partnerships, being in the Philippines and talking with people whose lives were nearly destroyed by Typhoon Pablo, and we helped, makes me realize we're difference makers, you know, so that matters. I look around the community, and anytime anything good is going on in this community, there'll be a lot of fellowship people behind the scenes making it happen. Just lately, we've had this 4-month in the Fox Cities, this 4-month focus on the Include Initiative, which is welcoming LGBT, affirming LGBT folks, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And if you looked at the leadership of that, a lot of fellowship people were very active in that, including Jesse, who I see in the back. If you looked at who was there at the closing gathering of that, 140 people, I think 20 or 25 were fellowship people. I would go further to say that I don't think the Include Initiative would have happened without this fellowship, honestly, because the groundwork that made that possible, to have such a high-profile welcoming campaign, I don't think the groundwork would have been there without us. So I value that. I think we're leading. I think we can do more, and I hope we do. Quick way to do that, I think, ultimately, and I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but I hope sooner than later, is a dedicated staff person whose job is a community organizer. That would be fabulous. I'm the staff person that is responsible for social justice here, and I've got a limited amount of time to do that with everything else. We have volunteers who have limited amount of times in their life. If we had someone for 10 or 20 hours a week even who was dedicated to community organizing, I think we'd be amazed at the results. So I hope that's going to happen. Day of Remembrance for Newton, 6 months. There's a gathering, and you're invited to be there Friday, 4 to 5, corner of College and Memorial Drive. I think this is for everybody. That's a great way to get an announcement in. So, but that's good. We need to remember. And it's, so I hope to be there. I have to look at the schedule. But 4 to 5, Friday, corner of College and Memorial. What are a couple things on your bucket list? I had this at the last one. All right. The thing that jumped to mind for me is visiting Sri Lanka, which was a country I lived in for 4 months during college, and which was then beginning a war that went until just a year or two ago. And I would really like to go back. I'm sure it will be vastly changed by this horrendous war that happened there, but I would like to go back. I had a dream about a year ago of going back, and it was really, really powerful. So that's one thing. I'll leave it at that. What do you like to do for fun? I love to hike, especially. That's probably my very favorite thing, backpacking, hiking. I am a Packers fan. I'm a Detroit Tigers fan. I like to eat good food. I like to drink good London ale. I like to be with family. I love watching my kids now as young adults. Stuff like that. I like to read. Okay, this one I may have help with, need help with. It says something about food, drink, walk, movie. Is it my favorite that you're looking for? Yes, okay. So favorite, oh yes, I get it now. Favorite food. I really like excellent pizza. And I like most things that are sweet. Favorite drink besides the London Ale would be, you know, there's nothing like filtered water when you're backpacking because you're really thirsty. Favorite walk. I have really enjoyed hiking in the Porcupine Mountains. And I shared a month ago, about a hike in Colorado up into this area where wildflowers were completely everywhere. Favorite movie remains A Little Princess. Kids movie. It's a great movie. Spontaneity, is it good or bad? Good or bad, yep. So... I like the question box because it's spontaneous, but I also like sermons where I get to actually think ahead of time. So both are good. Expectations, do we expect too much? We probably all do, especially of ourselves. What words of encouragement do you have for young adults to continue a church faith involvement when so many are disinterested? What I would say is that at some point you're going to need a community. And I'd say that to young adults, I'd say that to anyone. In the United States today, we lead more disconnected lives than any people in world history. And as long as everything goes great for us, I think that's probably fine. But we all know, you know, we're going to have losses, we're going to have failures, we're going to have illnesses, and we need people. So I would encourage any young adult to find a group of people to be connected with, and I think a congregation is a great place to look. I really love that this fellowship does pretty well, especially compared to most UU or other churches, in having a range of ages. And I think that's good for the fellowship. I like not just being around people like me demographically, but I think it's also good for each and every person who's here. You got people. We need people. Fear has always been my most powerful adversary, greatest enemy. But some people in this world seem to have evil intent. maybe because of mental illness or trauma, how do we shore ourselves against people like this? I think it's really important to know who we are and to know where we end. In other words, to know, this is me, and beyond that, it's somebody else. So I don't need to be solving problems for somebody else. I just need to be in relationship with them. And sometimes that's going to be really, really tricky. And sometimes to keep ourselves intact, we have to say, I have to put up boundaries here. Either these certain things have to happen or else I just can't do this relationship. I think that's healthy self-care. That's what I think we have to do in as compassionate a way as possible. That begins with self-knowledge. That's one I could do a whole sermon about. That's a great question. What is the best method to pray? I find myself always saying or asking the same thing. I would say, I don't know. So again, I say, find if prayer works for you, there's a million different ways to do it, so figure out which way works. And then maybe 10 years from now it won't, so you'll find something different. If prayer doesn't work, find something else. If it's meaningful to you to say to pray the same thing, then do it. If it's not, find something else to do. For me, prayer is meaningful, and it's meaningful especially as a way of centering myself and for expressing gratitude. So often my prayers do sound the same, but I find that meaningful to remember what I'm grateful for, even if it's the same thing day after day, largely. Still, so good to take time to realize that. So I don't think prayer is the magic answer for everybody, but I think it can be a good tool for a lot of people. What would you say if a parent of a gay child said and asked the following? I don't know if I can accept my child's sins when it comes to acting on homosexual feelings, even though I was taught to love the sinner, not the sin. What can I do to change him? So how would you respond to this parent? Great question. What I would respond to the parent about is just, I think people are who they are, and that everybody should be who they are. And I don't think this has anything to do with sin. I don't think it has anything to do with the mistake. I think it's just who somebody is. Straight, that's who somebody is. Bisexual, that's who somebody is, etc. So my job as a human being, I think, is to try to help people be who they are. Not to condemn, not to say it's their behavior that's... No, it's just to embrace. To embrace. That's what I think we have to do. Will that convince people? Not necessarily. I get that. One of my moments of truth in the Include Initiative was after I facilitated a discussion on the Bible. And this woman, about 70, came up to me, just eyes blazing. And just like, she said, it's just evil. It's disgusting. How could you say that? How could you embrace someone who's gay? Well, we have a lot of work to do yet. But all I could do is say, well, my brother's gay. I think he was born gay. That's who he is. And once I figured out that's who he is and that my job as a human being is to embrace for who he is, guess what? I could be in positive relationship for him, with him. Positive for him, positive for me. But I had to embrace him as he is. I don't know what's so complicated about that. Who would win in a fight? Okay. Neo from The Matrix, or Luke Skywalker, or Jesus. That one's tough. So I don't think Jesus, there's not a lot of stories about him fighting. So I'm thinking he wasn't that good at it. So I'm thinking one of the other two. It's kind of a dodge. How can we best honor our founders as they fade away? Founders of the fellowship, there's 9 people who started this fellowship. We have 3 are still surviving and remain part of the fellowship. What we can do is treasure them and what they did, welcome them when they come, and I think more than anything, try to keep this place going. these three people and their cohorts worked way harder than anyone has to now because it was just them for a long, long time. And there's nothing they would love more than to feel like this place is going to be around and thriving for a long time. And I think each of them feels that, and I'm really grateful for that. They also know, you know, hey, it's not my turn to be president, and that's okay too. They need to know there's other people stepping up. So I can say for each of these folks, the idea when they had 9 people that this fellowship would one day have 700 members must have been pretty inconceivable. And I think it's a source of great pride to them that this place has done what it's done. So we just have to keep it going. And know what we're doing now is way easier than what they did. What was your happiest, joyous moment of your sabbatical? Okay, hasn't happened yet. But, so I don't know. I'd have to say my last one. So I had one in 1996. The fun thing with that was having my family together in Chicago just before the oldest started kindergarten. I did stuff at Meadville Lombard, the UU Theological Seminary there, and that was fun. But mostly it was being in this big city with these wide-eyed little kids that was fabulous. Well, our congregation never get around to getting local community senior housing. That would be great. And it's going to take a lot of work, and it's got to be people who want to do it. We have the social justice task force process, where if you get 7 or more people who want to do something, form a task force, and then see if you can do it. We'll offer some support, but it's going to be a lot of heavy lifting. And I think it'd be really cool if we could do it. What do you personally want to achieve on your sabbatical? Said that. How do I balance my guilt of using fossil fuels to get there with the joyfulness I feel at the end of a service? Yeah. What I think is intentionality. Think about it. We all make choices. Think about it. Think of, is this a way I want to use this finite resource? For me, it is. It is, because I need community to live. I need community to know what I need to do in this world. That's it. I think, you know, you can connect with us through podcasts and you can email people, and I don't think it's quite the same as being here in person. And I don't know any way around that. Honestly, you know, probably buying a fuel-efficient car helps too, or biking if you're close, or walking. What was your favorite question from the last service? Or if that's cheating, what book would you recommend wholeheartedly to any adult member of the fellowship? Check the time. Second part first. The book that jumped into my mind is... Oh, geez, I got to remember the title. Encountering God. It's a book by Diana Eck from the late 1980s that I still think is a great book, stands the test of time. She reflects on her experiences growing up Methodist in Bozeman, Montana, and then becoming one of the world's foremost scholars on Hinduism, and sort of the meeting point of those two. Hugely influential book for me. Favorite question from last time. There was a really good question about remembering that when I last had a sabbatical in 1996, that in the aftermath there was a tough time for the fellowship where we were not getting along very well, and wondering how tied that was to the sabbatical. So that's naming a fear that I suspect is out there for those who have been around, you know, that long. I remember that, actually. And my answer would be a couple things were going on there. One thing was that I was the only minister, and really we had only very part-time staff otherwise. So the absence of me was a really big deal for the congregation, and it created a big vacuum, and people had to fill the vacuum. And I think a few people had, you know, had trouble unfilling the vacuum when I returned. Second thing is that we were at this critical point, and this is hindsight, but it was the worst possible time for me to take a sabbatical. And it was this critical juncture between being a small and a mid-sized congregation, the single hardest transition for a church. Now you tell me. Wasn't a good time to take it. And actually, we would have had the conflict, though, whether I took it or not. honestly, because that's what happens in that juncture. So that's what happened. And then I thought, well, I'm not going to take another sabbatical until we have another minister. And so, and I also didn't want to take a sabbatical when my kids were in school. So many years have gone by. And I was ready to take a sabbatical, and then Dottie, our second minister then, decided she needed to take a job elsewhere. So further delay. But finally, everything's set. My kids are off to college and beyond. We have another minister, Leah, who's wonderful and talented. And we have an amazing staff. And so I think it's going to be fine. I also think we're much healthier than we were then. We have real systems of health in the congregation. We've talked a lot about it for years. We have a healthy congregation team that's very much keenly aware that this is a critical moment and we'll be on the ball. So, you know, a congregation is always fragile. I get that. This is a fragile congregation, but I think it's a strong, healthy one, and I think we'll be fine. Are you excited about GH? GA, that's it, General Assembly. No. So, that's a cynical answer. Let me tell you why. So the UU, the Continental, I guess, now, yeah, it's sort of worldwide, but the Unitarian Universalist Association has its annual meeting once a year. It's in a couple weeks. It's in Louisville this time. I actually love to go and meet people, but in fact, I'm not signed up to go to GA. I'm going to be there for a minister's meeting beforehand, some UU Partner Church Council work I have to tend to. I love meeting colleagues, but I'm actually not going to go to much of General Assembly, so therefore I'm not really excited about it. It's expensive, and I just am able to go only for a small portion, so it didn't seem worth registering. I'll look forward to going the next year. The worship is amazing, and even though I'm not a delegate, I'll get to go to some of the worship, I think. What will the Unitarian Universalists of 25 years from now look like to us with today's eyes? Will services be online, two-way? Will our long name have changed? So actually, I think it's the UU. I think they mean this fellowship. If I had my way, we would be called the Fellowship, and then in parentheses would be a Unitarian Universalist congregation. I think we're known around here as the Fellowship. I think it's a great name. People can remember it. Lately, I'm getting a tour of a nonprofit in the community, and the longtime member who led the tour, stumbled on Unitarian Universalist. It's not an easy name, right? For us, let alone people out there. But there's heritage to it, so I don't want to lose it completely. But I think we ought to be known as the Fellowship. That's what makes sense to me. 25 years from now, man, who knows? Who knows? You know, there's so many things that are impossible to predict. My hope and my expectation is the Fellowship will still be thriving in some form. It may look different. Maybe there's more online. I think, though, the people-to-people thing is going to be still big. Direct human connection. I don't know beyond that. So I've been here almost 23 years. And, you know, what's interesting is everything's different about this place. First of all, place is different. We have more people here today than we had in the whole fellowship in 1990. That's big, big changes. And yet, there's a feeling here that's just the same to me. And I hear newcomers describe their experience here in very similar ways to 23 years ago. So my hope, looking ahead 25 years, is it's really different, and it looks really different, and it feels really different, and there's a continuity that feels the same. We've been able to do that for a while. I hope we can keep doing that. That would be amazing, I think. And that is the perfect last question. So, we have time for one or two responses or follow-up questions. Dale.
This is for Roger. When you pray, what do you pray for?
I will almost never pray for something actual. I may pray for discernment, you know, that kind of thing. But I don't actually pray for something to happen. Unless I'm really scared on an airplane and that sort of thing. And I always have to think, well, what was that about? That's it, you know, but generally, no, I don't. So what I pray for is for understanding, and I pray thanks. And I don't care, ultimately I don't know if or what who might be responsible for gifts in my life, but I know it's not me. So I say thank you. To whom it may concern. Which is often the joke way you use begin prayers. If there is anyone who may be concerned. It's true. But for me, it's about gratitude and discernment. That said, I know there's plenty of people in the fellowship who pray for specific things, and I'm not condemning that at all. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Thank you. I don't know about the fellowship here, but in the last couple of years, you were talking about the secularization that's coming to America, and there, well, at least on NPR and WPR, there was a lot of talk about, was it a Pew poll that I think where they were talking about, you know, the nuns? Yeah, that, and it, I always found it very frustrating that in all of those talks that Unitarian Universalism never comes up as a part of the discussion. So I don't know just about us, but it seems certainly nationwide that our denomination is not doing a very good job of making ourselves known, because it seems like for most of those people, I mean, maybe some are really don't want any kind of spiritual or communal practice, but it seems like most of them actually do, just not what they think is out there.
I couldn't agree more, and I think it's we have a golden opportunity here. When you think about the rise of the nuns, non-affiliated, you know, non-religious people, if there's any place where it's going to work, and I know it would for some, it's going to be Unitarian Universalism. In the last 5 years, Unitarian Universalism has declined about 1% a year. We're not doing it, folks. We're not doing it. We're not figuring out this challenge. And I think that's not only to our detriment, but to the detriment of our nation, our culture. Because I think we can be just an amazingly effective and impactful place if we can figure out this question. So it really bugs me that we're not working enough on it. It's annoying. So I think we're squandering a golden opportunity, which would not be the first time. But and we meaning you know nationwide. But at some point, you just die. You know, the golden opportunity stops coming, and I think we ought to take advantage of it. Yeah. Last one.
Two things. When you were talking about we keep declining and nationwide declining, I had the opportunity to go to a UU fellowship, the church, they called it, in Tennessee, and no children, no middle-aged people. They're all very elderly. The mean age was like 60 years old, and they went up to like 85, but nobody below 40. And they were very rich, but they had no growth because they had no children. So I think that's maybe part of the reason. In some of those areas, there we are persecuted, and we need to grow where we can grow. The other thing that comes up is when we were talking about our name, how do we do that? Because everybody calls us. I mean, when I'm out in the community, I go to the fellowship. Everybody says that, so how do we do it?
Well, that's a great question, and maybe it's something, as a that would probably take a congregational vote. It wouldn't necessarily change our name, but the way we use our name is a big deal. So maybe we need to think about that for next year. I think that'd be great. I agree. What I actually don't like in the community when we call it the UU, because most people are like, what is that? You know, the fellowship, though, I think is how we're known, and I would love to see it given prominence. And I think our PR committee could run with that, but I think we probably need some sort of collective saying, yeah, that's what we want to do. First thing, so you look at that congregation What's it going to look like in 25 years? It's going to be dead. Exactly. And that's really sad. And I've talked with people in those kinds of congregations, and they would love to have people younger, but they know if any younger person walks in the door, they look around, and they don't come back. We're really lucky here. We have people who look around and at least age-wise say, okay, I could be here. We got to keep that. We have to keep that or else we'll be on the same path. And too many UU congregations are like the one you visited. And it's a shame. Okay. That's sort of a downer note to end on. So, do you have a quick one?
I was going to say that same thing. I think we're called the Fellowship because no one knows what Unitarian Universalism is. And whenever I say that, I go to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Oh, what's that? And then I try to say the history of whatever. Yeah.
You get the glazed over look. Like. Okay. Good. Yes.
Positive one. I was this question I wish I'd asked. Over the next couple years, as you know, Leah really gets settled in, do you have any suggestions for things we as fellowship members can do to make her feel more welcome?
Oh, that's great. Thanks, Sam. That's a great question. So, Leah, our other minister, the best thing you can do in the next 6 months is behave. I bow at these things to give totally honest answers, and that really is honest because it's not going to be easy, you know. And there's going to be things that she can't get to that are really important, and you need to understand that. And all the help she and our other staff and leaders can get will be really greatly appreciated. So that's crucial. And then next spring will be the time of discernment for her and for us about whether we want to make this an indefinite long-term relationship through calling her as our associate minister. So, you know, stay tuned for that. And the best thing you can do in that process is have your voice be heard, but also come to our annual meeting next year when we will, in all likelihood, decide that question. Our bylaws call for a 25% quorum, to have a quorum, which is about 170 people. We just had a congregational meeting, and we had 70. So we need a lot more people next year. And a failure to achieve quorum would be a signal to Leah that we're not that interested. So mark your calendars. The Sunday between Mother's Day and Memorial Day, we're going to have a really important congregational meeting, time yet to be determined, and that'll be crucial. So thanks. That's a great question. I said at the annual meeting, and I'll say it again, I really am I'm loving working with Leah. She's fantastic, everything I hope for and more. And, you know, my opinion is I hope that she wants to stay and we want her to stay because that'll make me want to stay, too. If I can be blunt. Yeah. So let me say one more thing about that. I don't hold back sharing my opinion, and it's not ultimately up to me, it's up to the congregation, but I don't want you to be surprised. For me, that would be a big deal. So it's probably enough. I'll say more next year. All right, thank you.